This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, we will talk with Paul Carlson. He's the superintendent of the Lake County Fairgrounds in Crown Point. We'll talk about the facility, about the improvements made, and of course, all the work that is done on the complex, including the work that is done to get ready for the annual Lake County Fair, which is not handled by the county commissioners, but he's aware of everything that happens. In fact, the county fair is coming up about a month from now. We'll also have for you another conversation from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University, and we'll bring back our conversation with Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer about some of the federal tax code changes that may have an impact on your retirement. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. We're going to talk today about the Lake County Fairgrounds. Not the fair necessarily. That will actually happen next month, to be honest. And we'll have some more information for you about the fair itself and all the great events and the people that are involved with the Lake County Fair every year. But we want to focus today on the fairgrounds proper, the complex of buildings and land that is out there on the south edge of, actually maybe I should say not so much the edge of Crown Point. Now it's kind of, Crown Point's kind of wrapped around it now. It's like a lot of places that, where the community has grown around the property out there. And with us to talk about it, we have Paul Carlson. He's the superintendent of the Lake County Fairgrounds. Paul, thank you for spending time with us today.
Well, thank you for having us, Chris.
Well,
I enjoy your show, and I enjoy the fairgrounds. So,
well, I should
hope so. A good start.
I mean, for somebody that I know that has three bosses, and I'm not taking that lightly, you report to all three of the Lake County commissioners as your part of your job out there at the fairgrounds.
Yes, sir. I have three bosses, and I kind of look at it like everyone that uses the fairgrounds is my boss. Mm-hmm. If I can do something to help somebody out, I'll do everything in my power. Whether it's a dog walker or somebody camping during one of the events, we try to help everybody out. So we do what we can do.
The fairgrounds has a very storied history to us. Tell us a little bit about the history of the Lake County Fairgrounds. It goes back many, many years.
I have a little cheat sheet that I pass out to people that are interested in the history of the fair. And it starts out back in 1851 when the Lake County Agricultural Society was organized. Mm-hmm. The first county fair was held at the courthouse. So you can imagine the size of the change of things over the years. But they purchased Lake County Treasurer in 1856, Henry Wells, he was also the director of the Agricultural Society. He leased 5 acres of property on the south edge of Crown Point. It's the location of Allendale Parkway, and that was for the first fair. And that lease was to end in 1865 with a $500 purchase by the Agricultural Society. So, the first fair site was an existing site of an ice harvesting plant.
Uh-huh.
At Fancher Lake. That's approximately a 9-acre lake that we enjoy now with a fountain, and people love to fish there. So
I imagine it probably made a very good ice farm out there, too, when it was ice cold.
That's way before me.
When the lake was frozen over. Yeah, it was great to harvest out there.
Yeah. I talk to people. I can't even begin to imagine how it was to harvest ice.
I've seen pictures, and it was very difficult at best, I suppose. But it's interesting to see that they've taken a big lake and the land all around it, and it's become now the fairgrounds. When you have a chance to tell people about the history about this, what are some of the things that you've learned about from other people over the years of how the fairgrounds was used, and as well as for the fair itself?
I still find it amazing, even today. People are still telling me stories that and I have to believe them. And you know, about the donkeys, you know, jumping off the platform and into the lake, the big back in the day. I guess they had a big time entertainment, which was, you know, let's go before Dolly Parton, stuff like that.
But, right.
It was a great place. They had a zoo back in the day, before me. And as things progressed, you know, how with the treatment of animals, the zoo disappeared. You heard a lot of stories about snakes escaping from the fair, you know, going into Fancher Lake, ending up in Cedar Lake, or somebody drowning in Fancher Lake. They found them in Cedar Lake.
I think those are
tales that I.
I was going to say those are nice tales, you know. Pretty fanciful.
Yes, tales that I. Yeah. As a kid, I kind of believed them a little bit, but now I know better. I've seen. I know how the spring fed lake. I know how it kind of works, how it fills, how it drains. The fire department and the diving teams, they take pictures for us every now and then and let us see the bottom. And that's very, very deep lake, 40 to 50 feet out in the middle. So
that's one thing I would like to talk about now is a little bit about the physical layout of the fairgrounds. We mentioned this is a county fairgrounds in which the community has grown around it because it's been out there so long. Tell us more about how the layout is of the Lake County Fairgrounds.
And when we started there, I as a kid, I loved the fair. I fell in love with the fairgrounds, just the way it was. Now that I'm older and I see some of the changes, people finally realize it you could say it was neglected, but I being a realist, I know that there's other properties around the county that need attention, not just the fairgrounds. I appreciate every dime that we get out there for improvements. As people can see now with the new fence, it probably doesn't look like a prison property anymore. It really is a crown jewel. The buildings they were built, Chris, 100 years ago, or, you know, the building that we're officed in is built in 1926, the industrial building, and they probably just put $1.5 million in it over the last 3 years.
Yeah,
and it made such an improvement that I don't think we will have an open weekend to rent out after this. You know, it'll be booked every year.
That's one of the things I wanted to talk about too. Is the physical layout is such is that. Every single building has a use, not only during the fair itself, for whatever purpose it may be, whether it's to house animals or exhibits or whatever, in the weeks of the Lake County Fair, but it's also an opportunity for folks to be able to take advantage of the space out there for other events too, and they quite a range of events. I imagine people that want to lease the space out.
And Chris, a lot of people, they've been doing this before I started. You know, say like family reunions or. They like a certain shelter, just a, you know, pavilion. They've been doing it for 25 years. Another family or entity would like a 4-H building. Some like the fine arts. It's been cleaned up. Most of the buildings don't have air and heat. You know, the ones that we do, we rent them out all year long. But every little space, they love the structure. They love the old, the architecture of the building. There's something about it when you have a wedding reception in a building that's built over 100 years ago. So,
what's the largest building that's on the fairgrounds now?
It'd be the industrial building. It's where we have most of our big events. I think that's about 23,000 square feet. And it's, like I say, with $1.5 million they put into it over the past 3 or 4 years, it's just, to me, it's absolutely beautiful. Our renters, it's not just a wedding reception or a quilt show. these people, it's like a boat show, craft fairs that want to come back every year. Mm-hmm. So as this progresses, these are 2 or 3 day shows. When the average person comes in and say, boy, I'd sure like to have a birthday party in here or a wedding reception, it won't be available because it's just booked every weekend. It's just a beautiful place to have an event.
So. We're talking with Paul Carlson. He is the superintendent of the Lake County Fairgrounds in Crown Point. He and his crews are the ones who keep up the fairgrounds all through the year. And in particular, I guess you have a lot of extra work that about this time of year that you have to go through to get to the fairgrounds, as well as the people ready, I suppose, for the annual fair coming up in August.
Well, Chris, to keep the place operating, we operate 365 days a year. The gate is always open. I have 2 full-time employees beside my administrative assistant and myself, and I have 2 part-time employees. They rotate. So we keep the place open. During the summer, I have what they call seasonal help from May till September. Help me with weed whacking, chores like that. Like you say, to get, we sometimes look at it like we're taking care of the place 50 weeks to get the place ready for a 2-week fair.
Mm-hmm.
Try to keep it looking as nice as we can. And I think that everybody does a pretty good job. It's 86 acres, it's a lot of mowing, a lot of branches to pick up. But I think everybody enjoys what they're doing. It's a beautiful place to work.
Now, other than the sprucing up that you do, you have to do all the year round, I guess. But in particular, what kind of special things do you have to do towards the end of July in this case, because the fair is happening in August? What do you have to do in preparation for the actual Lake County Fair coming up?
Well, our fair is run by the Agricultural Society. It's not run by the actual county. Some county fairs are run by their county. So when it gets close, within a month, we start putting away, organizing our pole barn space. We start putting away stuff that might be in the way during the fair. We have to pick up all our trash barrels, our picnic tables that we don't use, we put away. It's the little doggy station. It looks nice during the year, but it might be in a vendor spot during
right.
the fair.
That's why I guess that's one of the things we mentioned, the fact that there's the fair, the people taking care of the fair itself have every single square foot pretty much plotted out. They have something planned
foot.
For every
yes,
place.
Sir.
And so with all the things that happen at the fair every year, ranging from the vendors, the concession stands, to the 4-H'ers with their exhibits that they're going to have to plan for, to the entertainment, there's something going on someplace, probably just about every square foot of the fairgrounds, I would imagine.
If you were to start your camera or your movie projector the last week of July and just let it sit there and watch that little city go up in a week with the tents and the trailers. And like you say, there's not a square foot that's not being used. It's just amazing to watch. I mean, we're not a campground, but somehow we accommodate over 75 independent campers that are vendors, and maybe another 50 or 60 horse trailers during the fair. So
I was going to ask you if a lot of these folks that come in and have to stay for the week, obviously the 4-H'ers, if they have exhibits and animals that they bring in for whatever it may happen to be, they're going to stay around or have to have someplace to stay around. I imagine some probably can come from home or from the farm, wherever they happen to be out there in the county, but just the same, some have to kind of come in and stay for the week, I would imagine.
Most of the kids are close enough where they can come in daily. Some of them with the more expensive, the horse type people with the more expensive animals, they will stay, they will camp. And I think they enjoy this week. Dad takes a week off of work and then spend a week out here camping. And they really enjoy it also. So
Well, now that we look forward to the Lake County Fair happening in August, when the fair is over with, or the 2 weeks are over, that they've been living out there and making a big mess of the place, I imagine. What kind of work, I guess this is where your seasonal staff comes in handy to be able to do the cleanup and help and get things back to shape again for the rest of the year at the fairgrounds.
Chris, the Agricultural Society has their own maintenance crew. They do a wonderful job maintaining the place during the fair and after the fair. When they hand it back to us, probably a week after the fair, we actually change the locks on the gate. Mm-hmm. And when they hand it back to us, everything is just as hunky-dory as when they got it. I mean, they do a wonderful job cleaning up.
So. What kind of comments and suggestions and whatever you get from residents in Lake County about the fairgrounds that you have found have been very, very helpful, especially in making improvements over the years here? And I know that a lot of it has come in the last year or so with the big investment that the county commissioners have put into the fairgrounds.
Yes, the neighbors, I mean, they all enjoy the fairgrounds. I think they like all the improvements, and they all feel like they're part of it. And they were part of us getting doggy stations. They helped out. They give us tips about, and they keep an eye on the place. If something's broke or if somebody turned on a faucet and left it, it's like they patrol it. I mean, they're there every day, the same time of day they do their walks. They really enjoy it, and they keep an eye on the place.
I would imagine too that the folks that live in town enjoy the setting that they're in because it's such a scenic setting in the middle of an urban area.
It's very nice, Chris. And I always tell people, I'm the one that checks the campers in for the fair. I switch over. I take my vacation from being the fairground superintendent over to. I go over to the Ag Society and I check these people in with their trailers, get them parked. All the people that travel the country, they might winter in Florida, they might live in Florida, and they do state fairs on the way up. Mm-hmm. They said, this is one of the prettiest parks that we play. And to me, that means everything in the whole world. I mean, they love the trees. They love the up and down atmosphere. It's not flat. And they're not sitting on blacktop, I really appreciate those comments from the people that travel the country.
Paul Carlson is the superintendent for the Lake County Fairgrounds, and he and his small staff help to take care of the fairgrounds through the year. And then, of course, the folks with the Agricultural Society take over and actually take care of the fairgrounds during the fair itself coming up here in August. Paul, thank you for spending time with us today. Give us a little history about the fairgrounds and what you and your folks do in keeping it up and keeping the place occupied during the months that the county fair is not happening there. Thanks for coming by to talk about it.
I thank you for having us, Chris. And like I say, everybody's welcome out there. I mean, every to walk your dog, to take a walk, just come and enjoy the place for a day. So
you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. This next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
I grew up right here in Gary. I was born here in 1938. Gary used to be a bustling city. Downtown was nothing but shops, stores, and everything. Citywide was nice new homes and all that. You didn't have a lot of vacant, dilapidated houses that you have today. This is going back in the 40s, coming forward. It used to be a very nice place to live. It's still a nice place to live in pockets in certain places. But you don't have the jobs that you have. You don't have the industry. You don't have the stores. You don't have all of that anymore like you used to. When I grew up as a youngster, there was only one integrated school here, and that was Frable. And the white students did not want us at Frable. They went out on strike for 2 months. But they finally relented, and we went to Frable. The only other school, high school, that we could go to was Roosevelt, and that was all black. And it wasn't until 1949 that they integrated Emerson. See, Gary was a very racist city. A lot of folks did not know that. Downtown, there's railroad tracks by the old Sears building. When the lights went out, you had to be on the south side of those tracks. You didn't be downtown. The Little Cal River on the south side out here, that was a dividing line between Gary and Glen Park. Now, Glen Park is a part of Gary, but that was a white area. We didn't live out there. We didn't even go out there. Passed through there, that was it. Crown Point, we live out there now, but at them days, we didn't live out there. The only time we went to Crown Point was when we went to court out there or we went to visit somebody in the county jail. We were channeled into our own little area. Same thing was in Chicago. They came up here from Mississippi. There was a big push to come up here to go to work in the mills. Blacks came. Come to find out, it was better down there than it was here because they channeled into the area on top of each other. Skokie, you didn't go into Skokie unless you went there to work. When night came, you better be out of there. But racism is inside people. Until you change inside, all the laws you can pass ain't gonna do a bit of good. A good example, 1974. They were busing the kids from Chicago out to the suburbs. Women out there in their house coats, curlers in their hair, spitting at the kids, throwing eggs upside the buses, because they didn't want the blacks in the school out there. Same thing was happening in Boston at the same time. Racism, it's a disease, I'll call it a disease, that people inherit. They're taught that by the adults around them. You can tell a child what to do. Don't do this or don't do that. But they're watching you and they're listening to you. That's how they're being taught. You got to start telling the child from the ground up how they're supposed to conduct themselves, how they're supposed to treat other people, how they're supposed to be treated. The only thing that I could say that I would change or try to change is the way people feel about each other. Color or your nationality shouldn't be a part of your life, nobody else's life. What do you have that you can give me? That's all I want, what I need. And when I say that, I don't mean money-wise or material-wise, but what do you have educational-wise? There's some things that you know that I don't know. And I'm 80 years old. There's a lot I can tell you. But we have to, like I say, respect each other and take what you have and use it to build on. That's all I can tell you. I enjoyed talking to you. And I hope that some of the things that I may have said will become a part of your regimen.
You can find more regional stories at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. We may have gone through the personal tax reform issues from the federal government. Now there's some other issues that the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, as it's officially called, might have on your retirement planning. And for that, we're turning to Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer. Greg, as always, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks for having me on.
Well, tell us a little bit about why we should be concerned about the changes in the federal laws that have impacted the tax returns that we are going to be dealing with this coming tax year, the one we're in right now, and what it's going to mean for those of us who are planning for retirement.
So there's a couple of actually several changes in it, and some of the most impactful things are the tax treatment. There's lower tax brackets right now. And the brackets have significantly increased, especially when you look at the single impact. The single tax preparer has always paid a lot in taxes, and there's been a lot of improvement for opportunity to do some effective planning. And the planning specifically entails possible ways to reduce the tax implications in the future based on doing some potential things today with your retirement accounts or how you're saving money and doing it all at a lower tax bracket.
We noted that also, too, that we have not only the lower tax rates and the fact that we've been asked to do our recomputation for our own returns to see what kind of impact it's liable to have, too. But when you're dealing with not only retirement accounts, too, it gets even more complicated, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely, because when you look at the impact on the actual return, that's just more data entry, making sure that there's the withholdings are matching up with the new tax rates, that they didn't adjust them too long to change your refunds. But when you're talking about opportunities, especially with retirement accounts, tax rates are the whole way taxes work in retirement, or what we call the distribution phase, is entirely different. And the sources of those incomes in retirement a lot of times will directly determine whether or not Social Security is reportable. So looking at potential conversions or things of that nature today with lower tax implications can prove beneficial and potentially save a considerable amount in tax implications for the rest of your life.
And I know we've always talked in the past year about the different types of retirement accounts that are available, the IRA, the individual retirement account, and the Roth IRAs. It's also commonly known. And if you make the conversion from one to the other, in particular from an IRA to a Roth, it's even more important that you get things right.
Yeah, absolutely. So contributions are always going to be directed by income. That's why the 401k is still going to be a valuable tool to get contributions in. But when you do a Roth conversion, there's a couple things just to be careful of. On the pure math of it, the simple thing is there's an arbitrage. You're going to be able to convert those dollars today to cheaper dollar than more likely than will be in the future. And what I mean by that, Chris, is the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act is supposed to end in 7 years. I mean, that's what it is. It's a 7-year proposal, and then you're supposed to revert back to the old tax laws. Well, just by simply looking at the tax implications under the old and new, there's a substantial potential savings just because of the tax bracket change. But when you're converting, you do have to pay the taxes, and you have to be cognitive of how much you're converting, you know, whether that's going to force your current brackets into situations that may not prove as beneficial. And they have changed some of the recharacterization rules.
Yeah.
You know, used to be if you converted a Roth and for some reason you wanted to change your mind, you could recharacterize it back to a traditional and basically undo it. And they've gotten rid of that provision now.
Mm-hmm. In fact, you have a deadline, I understand, too, that you have to meet to be able to do it.
Yeah, and the October 17th deadline is for those folks that actually still did it in 2017 when it was still allowed. But any conversions this year basically are permanent.
Now, I wonder, in light of all of this and with the fact that this is only a 7-year law, and you just, as you've mentioned, as we know, I wonder if Americans will pressure their lawmakers to make sure that there are changes made so that the things will continue on beyond the 7 years instead of ending at that deadline.
Yeah, and a lot of that, I think, is just going to depend directly on how the economy continues to run, how things, you know, impact, because, you know, part of any tax cut is the anticipation of more revenues from, you know, a surging economy because people are spending money. But my concern simply is, you know, these are the lowest tax rates have ever been, and we still have that debt that's out there as a country that eventually needs to be resolved.
Well, I haven't seen a swelling in my paycheck because of it yet, unless it's just too early to tell, I suppose.
And that's it. It's small dollars. You know,
yeah.
For most folks, Chris, you're exactly right. You're seeing, you know, a difference of maybe $100, $150 a pay period, depending on how you're paid. It could be smaller if you're weekly. You know, so for a lot of folks, it's not as significant.
One of the other points, too, we want to bring up here in talking about the changes and the impact that this new law is going to have on your retirement account is talking about how the estate and the gift taxes, if you are eligible to be affected by them, will be changing. Tell us about that.
So essentially, under the new Tax Cuts and Job Act, it's doubled. The estate and gift tax law has doubled. Under the old law, it was $5.6 million exemption. Under the new law, it's now 11.2. And essentially, in English, Chris, what that basically means is an estate's not going to be subject to what they used to refer to as the estate tax unless there's an estate value over $11.2 million. So for most folks, it basically eliminates any type of implications to pass money on as a legacy to children or other heirs.
We're talking with Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer about some of the changes that the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, as the federal reform is known, is going to have on retirement accounting here in your money. And one of the things we often talk about is the impact of charitable deductions and what we should be doing if we want to be sure that we get the right deductions counted on our taxes and the like. And there are some big changes coming in this respect we should know about, too, isn't there?
Yeah, and I think this is probably the one that's going to be more impactful for folks that are making charitable contributions that are in the required minimum distribution phase because of the doubling of the standard deduction. Essentially, it's going to be difficult for most people in retirement just by the natural evolution of retirement. You generally don't have as much mortgage interest. You generally don't have as much state tax you're paying. It's going to be almost impossible for the majority of folks to itemize. Well, with the current laws, charitable donations that are made directly from your IRA accounts to your charitable charity of choice, as long as they're in the RMD part of their distribution, in other words, they're over 70 and a half, those contributions can be deducted. So they don't have to fall under the rules or the aggregation of the item or the standard deduction before they can itemize. You can simply report that on your tax return as what we call a charitable deduction, a QCD, a qualified charitable deduction, and it reduces your tax immediately off the tax return, and you're able to, in essence, deduct the contribution that you make to your organization.
Now, I know that one of the other things that came about is the Reform Act that was passed is that, and you mentioned here about the standard deduction, it's basically doubled now, and that means that fewer taxpayers are going to be able to take advantage of it for medical expenses, I would imagine, too.
Yeah, and the medical expenses, again, you're exactly right, Chris, because the doubling of the exemption is going to, or the standard deduction, I should say, is going to make it more difficult. Medical expenses have reverted back for the 7.5% of the adjusted gross income, but that jumps up now to 10% in 2019. So the only strategy that we could see that may be of value, and this is not always available to a lot of folks, but if you're close to being able to itemize and if you can bunch or group certain medical expenses that are maybe not critical, right? We don't want to delay our health care to try to bunch medical deductions, but a lot of times, you know, being cognizant of the fact that I got to have dental work done or I got to have a procedure done and I'm at the beginning or near the end of a year specifically, you know, is it worth looking at getting it done by the end of the year because I could make, you know, have the opportunity to have that become part of the itemized, or should I push off into the following year where I can bunch it in that year and then create a better tax advantage?
Mm-hmm. I understand that you learned a lot about these changes, the latest from a training workshop that you attended recently about all of this. And tell us what this training workshop was pretty much all about and what some of the other participants besides yourself had a chance to talk about in between sessions over a cup of coffee or maybe later in the day over something a little stronger and how it's going to affect everybody.
Yeah, I mean, I belong to a number of different organizations for ongoing training just to keep up, you know, to date with a lot of the information that is constantly changing. And the EdSlot organization has been proactive with IRAs and understanding IRAs and tax planning around IRAs and, you know, what's allowed, what isn't allowed, the specific tax law changes. And so we aggregate as an organization twice a year to, you know, fine-tune our knowledge on recent changes and then interact with other folks about opportunities to work with clients, ideas, thoughts, processes that they feel could be beneficial to the consumer to help produce better results for either, you know, their overall retirement planning or on the tax return or opportunities just in general to save on taxes. Mm.
Are these people that you work with or know of here in Northwest Indiana or the state of Indiana for that matter or Illinois?
It's actually national. It's a national organization. So there's a couple of us here in Northwest Indiana, but it stretches pretty much, I believe they touch just about every state. So we aggregate different areas. This year we were in Philadelphia, and we just picked different locations across the nation, and everybody comes in and shares ideas, thoughts. It's really it's a great opportunity to work with your peer group and people that are serious about staying up to speed and up to date on their education and how they can provide value to their consumer and to their client.
Now, you get the impression that, that everybody was a little bit concerned here on the when the law finally took effect and that they were going to get, besides having to deal with tax returns, that's always the thing that turned out here that came at the wrong time. It could have happened, I suppose, some other time before the time that everybody had to start working with their clients to get their taxes prepared for the year. And it was during a time when the changes in the law didn't take effect yet. So it probably got everybody confused, and it probably had a chance to maybe get a little breather now.
Yeah, and actually now that we know what is in place, because there was still some things that were changed last minute, we're actually, for most of us, are pretty excited about the opportunity because we feel it's going to be, you know, one of the rare opportunities to take advantage, you know, when you do income planning and you have an opportunity to distribute from taxable accounts at a more effective tax rate. It's just understanding how to make that opportunity a reality and understanding the cause and effect in the whole overall income plan. Most of us are very excited about the opportunity we have and the ideas and thoughts to share with our clients.
Well, let's hope that that enthusiasm goes over and affects the clients and makes them feel a little more comfortable about dealing with their funds that they are setting aside for retirement. We appreciate you talking today, Greg.
All right, Chris, thanks. I enjoyed chatting with you, and thanks for having me on.
That's Northwest Indiana Financial Advisor Greg Hammer. The Northwest Indiana Symphony Orchestra is getting ready to go on the road, so to speak, for its annual South Shore Summer Music Festival. Music director and conductor Kirk Muspratt told me that it all gets underway in just about 2 weeks from now.
Our first concert is on the 21st in Cedar Lake, and it's on a Saturday night. The next Saturday, we're in Crown Point. And then we move in August to the Dunes on Friday the 3rd of August. On the 4th of August, we are in Griffith. That's Saturday evening. On the 8th of August, that's a Wednesday evening, we're in Valparaiso. And then our last two concerts of the summer are on the 10th and the 11th of August. That's at Wolf Lake on the 10th and Sherrville on the 11th.
I know a lot of people do enjoy the music over in Valparaiso, so it's always you're able to kind of shoehorn in one of the summer festival nights for the folks that are over in Porter County.
Yes, they deserve it too, and we love playing there. It's a great night, such a nice space, and the audience first of all, it's always packed, and they're really a wonderful audience. They're very in tune with the orchestra, and we have a blast over there.
Well, okay, now we know where they're going to be held. Tell us what is on the schedule for the selections that folks will hear when they make it rounds on the Summer Music Festival this year.
Okay, I'd be happy to. I'm going to do what we've always done because that's what people seem to like. We'll start with some light classical music of Johann Strauss and Tchaikovsky and von Suppe. Then I'm going to start moving away. The next thing I'm going to do is actually some country and western music. Then I'm going to do something called the Crime Fighters Medley, which is like the 30 seconds of all the hot crime fighter theme tunes back to back to back. We're going to play a new version of America the Beautiful that we just got. It was premiered at Carnegie Hall about a year ago, and it is really a beautiful version of this important song. And then the first half ends with Mission Impossible. The second half of the concert is all movie music, whether it's Pirates of the Caribbean or Prince of Thieves or How to Train Your Dragon. And then we're going to do some E.T. and some Star Wars music to end.
Of course. You have to have some Williams music in there to be sure.
Oh, yeah.
You'd be remiss if you didn't, to be sure.
He's a fantastic genius.
That's Northwest Indiana Symphony Orchestra conductor and music director Kirk Muspratt. Once again, the Summer Music Festival gets underway this year with its first concert on July 21st along Cedar Lake. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. There are a lot of things happening with films in the city of Gary these days, and not only things that have happened, but things that are coming up for the summer months as well. Let's turn now to the lady who has founded and is the director of the Gary International Black Film Festival. Karen Toering is with us to talk about it. Karen, welcome to Regionally Speaking.
Hey, thanks.
Well, first let's take here a look at what has happened, because I know that before we start to actually talk about the upcoming 8th Annual Gary International Black Film Festival, which is coming up in October, let's talk first about the collaboration that you all have had with the City of Gary, working in an art house, a social kitchen, which is the official name of the building there right across the street from the baseball park. But there have been a lot of films that have been shown in recent months here that I think people in Gary have enjoyed. Tell us about them.
We did a pretty comprehensive survey in 2017 about what the audience wants from the Gary International Black Film Festival. So, you know, because that's how we program, you know, based on what people say they want to see and what they want to talk about. And one of the things that the consistent theme that kept coming up was we want films in our community. We want you to come to where we are. And we tried that in 2016 and 2017. Just wherever someone wanted us to be, we would go there, we would set up the equipment, but we found that conditions were rarely ideal, you know, for a theatrical film screening. And so we reached out to the art house and asked, well, what would it look like if we were to basically convert the space into sort of a theater, mm-hmm. you know, a mini cinema. And they said yes, and we said yes. And for the last 5 months, we've been screening a monthly film and culinary series. So, you know, Art House, the Social Kitchen, is a partnership that was developed to encourage entrepreneurial chefs, right? Mm-hmm. And so we were like, oh, great. I love eating while watching movies. So we got with the art house, and they paired a chef with each of the films, and we tried to keep the food somewhat thematic throughout the series. And, yeah. and that was pretty successful. The first time, we had just a few people. They were like, what? you movie, dinner and a movie in the same place. So we had a few people show up. And then these last two screenings, one, we invited the Michigan City Steppers because we did a film that was about a young girl who was part of a step team. So the Steppers came and brought their families, and we also had, you know, sort of a food that young people like, for example, you know. So the chefs basically prepared, you know, something that was more amenable to young folks. And it was pretty successful. And then just this past week, we showed a film about historically black colleges and universities, and we brought in the Black Greeks, the Kappa Alpha Psi, and that was also a pretty successful event. So
that's
we
great.
Think we might want to continue that of, you know, sort of bringing in the chefs, letting them try out their special dishes based on a theme, you know, because chefs are artists as well, and they, you know, they like that challenge. And then bring in the community in to watch your film, talk about it, and have some really great food.
Now, we know that on television, there was a program, Dinner and a Movie, where basically mm-hmm. they had chefs come on and prepare things. Mm-hmm. And, of course, then they showed mm-hmm. the movie on TV. But this is better still. This is actually a theater where people can sit and not only enjoy the meal, but watch a film, too. That sounds like a very interesting idea. And I'm certainly sure that others in the community are hoping that you'll be able to bring that back next year, to be sure. Now, besides the film series that you finished up on, one coming up here is, because it's summer, it's going to be time for Movies in the Park, which is, I know, the collaboration that you all have with the City of Gary at Marquette Park. Tell us about that.
Yeah, we also have one of the things that because we are a submissions festival, which means that filmmakers from around the world submit their films to the film festival, and we have a group of folks that volunteer and actually review those films and may help us make those selections for the festival. But we get a lot of short films, and, you know, there's really no place for a filmmaker who has made a short film for their films to get screened before a larger audience. And so we reached out to the city of Gary, and we said, what if we did a short film right before the film that in the movies in the park, and that way these artists continue to get some kind of, you know, exposure for their films. And so the first film they screened in June was Black Panther, and we were like, okay, let's find a really good short sci-fi related film. And pair that with the feature film. And so throughout this summer, every time there is a Movies in the Park, you'll see a short film from an independent filmmaker right before the main feature, and that helps us to continue to help these artists get their pieces out.
That's great.
To the community.
That's going to be great. It'd be very interesting, and certainly will promote the annual Gary International Black Film Festival as well, too, because I'm sure that the people that, that will see these independent films ahead of the main feature will know about this, and maybe that'll get them interested in getting involved in the film festival come this fall, to be sure. That's very interesting.
Exactly.
How much work do you have to do in coordinating all this with the city of Gary?
Well, the city of Gary is pretty easy to work with.
Mm-hmm.
By the way,
well, that's good to know.
So far they've really been gracious and generous and helping us to, you know, move audiences to the film. So we're pretty pleased with that partnership.
That's right. We're talking with Karen Toering, who is a native of Gary, Indiana, and amongst all of her duties and work, she is the founder and the director of the Gary International Black Film Festival, which, by the way, coming up will be the from 2018 will be the 8th annual such film festival, and it's going to happen in the second week of October. If you will now, Karen, let's focus in on the big festival itself coming up. What are some of the big features that are going to be available for people to see if they attend the festival this year?
Well, right now we're in the process. Okay, first of all, First things first, the festival is October 12th through the 14th. Mm-hmm. It's going to be at Indiana University Northwest, one of our longtime partners, at the Berglund Auditorium, which is the smaller auditorium on the campus. And we are in the process right now of reviewing films. So if there are filmmakers out there that would like for their films to be screened in the festival and they want us to take a look, they can submit by going to our website, and that is gibff.org, to submit your film. So we're screening right now. We're hoping to have, we've got a couple of films that we've curated, which means we've reached out to the filmmaker and asked to screen their film. And I don't want to reveal the names yet, because that's always the best part.
Oh, sure.
is learning, you know, about who's going to be at the film festival. Plus, we haven't locked the schedule in. We don't normally do that until September, 1 month before the film festival. We lock the schedule in, and then we start telling people, okay, this is the film. One of the things that always happens every year is people go, well, what films do you have? And if we give you the list of all of the films, there's a 99% chance that you've never heard of it before.
Yeah.
But what we guarantee is that the film is going to be powerful. It's going to move you in different ways. You're going to laugh. You're going to think. You're going to go, I didn't know that about that particular thing or country or person. And that's what we guarantee to deliver.
I guess, as it was happened in past film festivals, that there have been a very interesting mix of films, of narrative and documentaries and dramas, shorts and animated works. It runs the gamut, I guess, of whatever the genre happens to have available. So it's worth checking out by going to IU Northwest, to the Berglund Auditorium, for the festival coming up. Also, too, I know that you have built into the festival some other special events that come along, too. Among them are some other special celebrations that are happening, and something called a Gary Showcase. These are things that happen every single year?
Yes, they happen. We kind of just fell into that. The first year that we launched the film festival, we brought in, for the opener, we brought in a little-known independent filmmaker at the time. Her name is Ava DuVernay. Now, everybody knows Ava DuVernay for Selma and 13th and Queen Sugar and What's the one about the Disney one that she just did? Anyway,
okay.
A filmmaker who was at the time emerging, and 8 years later, she's doing $100 million films. But the other thing that we did was that we dedicated Sundays, which is the last day of the film festival, to a local filmmaker. And we actually, the first year, we didn't know that this would be a continuing sort of thing, but it's turned out that folks really, really like to see local filmmakers highlighted and represented in the festival. So Sundays are always Gary Day. So you're always going to see a film that has a deep connection to Gary on Sunday. I shouldn't say always, because you should never say that, right?
Well, yeah, you hope for the best. You hope that you have that, you know, every single year.
Yes.
I'm sure, yeah.
Yes, but we, you know, every year. And because, you know, that's the other thing that we have learned as film festival programmers, is that there's a lot of talent in Gary. A lot of talent in Gary. And so far, 8 years running, we've been able to show a film to close the festival that has a direct connection to Gary. So we feel pretty lucky about that.
That's great. Well, Karen, we are going to have to get back in touch and get you on again here once you have a better idea of what the schedule looks like here as the 8th annual Gary International Black Film Festival gets underway this year. It's going to be October 12th through the 14th. It'll be in Berglund Auditorium, which is on the IU Northwest campus in Gary, of course. And Karen Toering, thank you very much for spending time with us to talk about not only the projects that you're working on ahead of the film festival, but a little clue for folks that maybe are not familiar with what the International Black Film Festival is all about. They'll certainly look into it more, and we'll have you back on to talk in more detail about it a little closer to the event. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and thank you for joining us today. Tomorrow, we have a special 4th of July program, Capital Steps. And then on Thursday, we offer a Best of Reporters Roundtable Thursday program.